views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
To go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main
they are
hard. Start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good morning, everybody. Welcome to our Friday Space Show program. I am your host, and it's great to be here. And thank you all for tuning in as well. We have a great show planned for you today. So let's get into the announcements and on to our program. For those of you who would like to call and talk to our guest, Dwight Stephen Bonicki, then you can reach us at toll-free 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners, so be patient. Let the phone ring, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. Also, do remember that we often will hold the caller over the break if your call is relevant. And if the line is free, we do answer the line during the break as well. And if you're waiting and waiting and waiting to get in on the toll-free line, we only have one toll-free line. So don't hesitate to send me an email and tell me to move the caller on to make room for other callers, and I'm happy to do that. And then remember that our website is thespaceshow.com, and we have a detailed, comprehensive newsletter there. It's in the middle of the page. You can't miss it. So that has all of the information about the upcoming shows, guest bios, and it's the only place where you'll find a future events section as to what's in store on the Space Show for the next couple of weeks, sometimes into several months. And then if we have to modify or change our schedule, which does happen from time to time, we do it first on the website newsletter. So I urge everyone to check it from time to time to stay current with our weekly programming. We also send out a very short email newsletter early Monday morning, California time, and that just has one or two lines about the programs that will air during the week. And if you want to receive that very short email Monday morning, then please send your email address to me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, DRSPACE. Everything we do is archived. They're all on our website going back to 2001 when we started the show. We're coming up on 13 years. You can easily download these programs, and you can also share them with people around the net who you think should be interested or will be interested in learning more about space or the particular topic of one of our programs. And a show is about 44 megabytes. So if you need any assistance or instructions on how to send a file that large through email, please let me know. I'd be glad to help you. Very few rules. Just don't do anything commercial. Don't edit the programs like for YouTube or your own website for that matter. And then in addition, please don't download printed or written transcripts or make them. We don't have permission to do that, and we appreciate everybody following these simple rules. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website, or you can easily download the program. There's a store on our website. It's up near the upper left corner. It says Space Show Gear. Please do check that out. And then probably the most important button there is the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And we are able to do this program because many of you do support us financially. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your contribution. The same is true for those of you paying California taxes. And then in addition, remember that we do podcast. We thank Andrew Grummet at Gigadial.net for his podcasting help and services. You can find us in Microsoft Zune and in iTunes and in a host of other places on the net. If you have any podcasting questions, don't hesitate to let me hear from you. Finally, do remember that we are partially brought to you and sponsored by the Secure World Foundation. Secure World promotes cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, you can visit their website, which is www.swfound.org. And that brings me to today's show. Our guest is a returning guest, Dwight Stephen Bonnicki. Hopefully I got that right. And he's in Germany, but he's author of the book Live TV from Orbit, which is a sequel from his first book, which is when he was on the show the first time, Live TV from the Moon. Dwight was born in Australia a few months before we started walking on the moon. I guess that's a few minutes, too. He spent much of his childhood fascinated with space exploration, like so many of us. He grew up in the shadow of Apollo and under the direct influence of sci-fi films such as Star Wars, the latter shaping his desire to work in the film and TV industry. So after studying television theory at North Sydney Technical College, he moved to San Diego. He interned with Daniels Cable Television. Then he returned to Australia and worked at TCN9 before heading back to university, where he majored in psychology. And from his studies, he decided that TV was where he wanted to be, so he returned in the industry working for Foxtel Australia. From there, he heard about the expansion about satellite TV into Eastern Europe. He jumped on a plane, went to Europe, first to the United Kingdom, then he went on to Germany, which is where he is today in Cologne, Germany. And he has written some great books, Live TV from the Moon, for example, and now he has Live TV from Orbit, which we're going to be talking about. This book is an Apogee book, and on top of that, it has a CD in it, and we'll ask Dwight to explain the CD in a little while on the show. Dwight, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on the show again. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
So give us the introductory 101 for Live TV from Orbit.
Well, it actually, originally I researched everything in one hit, and that when I was doing Live TV from the Moon. And it came about because every time I spoke with Stan LaBar over the phone, like I'm talking to you now, he would always divert the discussion to Skylab and ASTP. And I always used to think, why that? Aren't the moon landings are the most important thing television-wise that you've worked on? And he was like, no, you don't understand. There was so much work involved in these two projects that it's interesting for me to talk about them. So I slowly started researching, and before long I found out there was a lot, exactly like you said, there was a lot of information. So I put it on hold and just concentrated on the first book. And then once that was out of the way, then I started researching Skylab, ASTP, and the TV system that they developed for the space shuttle. And that was a five-year journey. It was a lot of work, exactly like Stan had told me.
And could you find a significant, aside from the fact that one Skylab was not the moon, is there a significant difference in what went on the Skylab missions for technology, television, making history on it from the moonwalks? Which was more complicated, do you think?
Skylab was way more complicated as far as the technology went than any of the Apollo missions, excluding ASTP. In my opinion, ASTP was the most complicated project of all the NASA endeavors, precisely because they had two cameras on the command module, two cameras on the Soyuz, and they had to work together with the Russians. And that was just, when you read through the memos and the documentation in pre-mission planning, the fact that they got beyond the agreement is a miracle in itself, and considering what's going on with Russia at the moment, it looks like they're going back down that road, but that's left for another another show. And then the follow-on, the development of the CCTV system for the space shuttle, that was mammoth as well, because that was up to seven cameras on board, envisioning everything that went back to the early days of NASA planning, you know, having a camera in the cockpit on the extended the Canadarm. These things were all envisioned for prior projects and all came to fruition on the space shuttle. So it is a long path to the end product, which culminated in the space shuttle.
Why would Skylab be more complicated than Apollo? I mean, going to the moon seems like it'd be far more complex and you're really far away. And why is it more complex to do Skylab?
For the fact that when you're on the moon, as long as it's line of sight, there's no trouble. You can keep the antennas pointed at the moon as long as the Earth is facing the moon, where the satellite, the receiving dish is. You've got no trouble unless a meteor hits the satellite dish. You know, you will still get the TV picture. With Skylab orbiting the Earth in low Earth orbit, you have a limited window of opportunity to get a downlink from any particular receiving station. So they had approximately 12 minutes of usable airtime. If they wanted to download downlink television, they had 12 minutes to do it. So they had to plan, when do we start, what are we going to show, and when do we finish? And it was like they wouldn't want to do an experiment and halfway through lose signal.
So you get 12 minutes every time it makes an orbit. Is that what you're talking about?
To any particular ground station in those days. Today it's a little bit different. They've got arrays and so forth and multiple sites that can receive television, whereas in those days they had Canberra, Madrid, and Goldstone in California. And they were the three sites that were the primary sites to receive television. So they only had the window of approximately 12 minutes. And that's where all the headaches came from, because they had to plan how do we incorporate a television schedule into the fact that Skylab is rotating, orbiting the Earth, and also at a different location each time it passed over of whichever tracking station was following it. What they then decided to do to combat this logistical problem was to build a VTR on board, so that they could do telecast, not necessarily downlink them live, but they could at least record what they wanted to, for example, solar observations or experiments that took longer than 12 minutes. They record them onto the videotape and dump them down to the receiving station at a later pass. And that way you get longer sequences of video to watch now, but in the day they weren't transmitted live.
But so they had to be able to make the data dump within 12 minutes, though, right?
That is correct. They could. They also, because it was coming off tape, they could rewind the tape. They could stop it, start it from any point they wanted, and then just edit the material down on the ground. So then they would have a flawless recording.
Did they do any live TV?
Yes, they did. Now, this brings up a very good discussion. I'm obviously too young to remember any of the live footage. Someone had asked me what aspects of Skylab were actually telecast live on the networks in the United States, and I honestly could not answer. I have certain snippets from the evening news, but as far as experiments and so forth that they did in real time, I couldn't honestly tell you what was broadcast to the general public live. What was definitely broadcast were the launches, and as Skylab 2 approached the damaged space station with the Conrad crew, that was telecast live. But then that had already reached a point in the American psyche that they the public just wasn't interested, unfortunately, and so the people running the news departments would also say, look, it's not newsworthy, we're not showing it, and we only have showing a highlights package on the evening news.
Why do you think public interest wasn't there? Do you address that?
Yeah, precisely because it became so commonplace that people were like, been there, done that. What's so important about an orbiting space station? We've been to the moon. Who cares?
So we got spoiled.
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely.
And was this global or primarily in the United States or the West?
Uh, I, I hate to say it, but unfortunately, predominantly in the U.S., I do know as a child, I do vividly remember watching Apollo 17 live, so we were still telecasting moonwalks, whereas the U.S. had decided highlights only. As far as Skylab goes, I can't remember. I'm still, unfortunately, too young. For example, the ALT test of the space shuttle in 1977, I remember watching them in Australia live. Right, whether or not there was that much live in the US, perhaps one of the callers who called in later on can enlighten me. That was one of the hurdles I had, and because Stan LaBar was no longer alive while I was researching this book, I didn't have anybody I could ask. So it was I was relying very much on the Vanderbilt news archives, but they only show news highlights. So very difficult question to answer.
So that it's interesting because do you think if we mounted another large human spaceflight program today, the population would get bored, disinterested, and it would go away? Because this is always an argument, you know, in the space community. We're not doing anything of interest. And if we do, like if we went to Mars, for example, surely we'll capture everybody's interest and it'll always be there. But that doesn't seem to be the track record, does it?
No. I recall when the Pathfinder was first transmitting back from Mars, there was huge interest. I think the problem these days, there is a mammoth amount of interest when it first happens, and then it quickly dies down. That is, for example, we always talk about it now, working in television, you know, somebody comes on and goes, oh my God, this is the worst thing since whenever, and I think, wait 2 weeks, everybody will have forgotten all about you.
Unless they're doing something that makes each, I guess each time they come over or something is interesting in like a totally different episode or something. You almost need to do a virtual reality TV show and have the crew doing something different or something to keep your attention.
True. I also think these days with the web, it would make it a lot easier to do a multimedia package, you know, so it's not necessarily all the time just a stream of video. There's photos, there's data. That would work, and I think that would be very successful.
Possibly we'll find out. Maybe your next book will be live TV from suborbital tourism flights or something like that. We'll see how the public reacts to all of that. In doing your research for Skylab and the Apollo Soyuz test stuff, what did you find to be the most exciting and surprising?
Oh, that is a good question. I didn't plan for that one. Oh, dear. I thought actually one of the most interesting things was prior to starting the second book, beg your pardon, I was down in Canberra at the Tidbinbilla tracking station. And Glenn Nagel, who runs the visitors centre, said, look what we've discovered. And he took me to the back room and he took a flown ASTP video camera out of the closet and said, look, we have no idea how this landed here. We assume it was a part of a tour package that the US had done to promote the project back in the 70s, and it somehow ended up here. He ended up contacting Stan LaBar from Westinghouse and gave the serial numbers, and Stan confirmed, yes, this went up on the flight. We have no idea how it wound up in Canberra. So then Glenn said, and there's also these switches and things on the back of the camera. What's that all about? And Stan looks at it and goes, we never modified this camera. I have no idea what these modifications are all about. And that was in 2007, thereabouts. And then I'm going through all the documentation for the CCTV systems for the space shuttle, and I come across a set of memos that are talking about reusing the ASTP cameras in case the RCA system for the space shuttle was not ready for flight. Then they go through and describe the modifications done to the camera. I look at the emails that Stan had sent me regarding his thoughts on what happened to the Tidbinbilla camera. And it's like, aha, that camera was one of the ones modified for the space shuttle that had flown on ASTP with modifications in case the RCA system wasn't ready. And it found its way into Tidbinbilla. And if you happen to be in Australia and you go to the visitor centre, that is now on display.
What were the modifications for? What did they enable the camera to do?
Remote control, and I think something to do with the gamma settings, which were never part of the Westinghouse specs for that particular camera. And it's certain features they wanted for the lighting conditions on the space shuttle, if I remember correctly. It was really we have to do this in order to get it ready in case the thing flies in 1978. But it never came to fruition. So these modifications were done, a couple of memos stored in the archives, and that was it, forgotten about.
Here's your first email question. This is Sarah, is in Chicago. And Sarah says, how difficult was it during the Cold War to get Russia and the United States to cooperate on this space mission?
Hi, Sarah. It was incredibly difficult. When you read through the preliminary discussions, the politicians had no trouble signing the pieces of paper to agree to the joint mission. It's when the engineers tried to get their counterparts in the Soviet Union to be forthcoming with information, that's when it kept hitting stumbling block after stumbling block after stumbling block. And the Americans started to get a little bit impatient with that, saying, look, we cannot go forward if these guys, all they're doing is withholding information. You know, it's directly opposed to the American philosophy of everything's open. We televise, we film, we photograph everything, and the public can see it. The Russians, everything was secretive. Most of the Russians didn't know, for example, that Valentina Tereshkova was the first woman in space until after the mission had started, not even her mother. So you can imagine that type of mentality, trying to cooperate with the open Americans, it was a nightmare. Luckily, there were some very dedicated people on the team who insisted that the Americans and the Russians work together, and those stumbling blocks, they were in the early days. Once the program started to go through final planning in late 1974, then it became relatively easy because they had gained the trust with each other. With the one exception, when the launch happened in the Soviet Union, the press was not allowed on the launch site. They had to stay in Moscow. And the press were actually quite upset and wanted a tit-for-tat action that the Americans would ban the Russians from observing the Saturn 1B launching. But the Americans turned around and said, no, that's not our mentality. We are not going to do that. If the Russians want to do that, let them. It only helps our cause better. And so they did manage with very, very difficult steps forward to get the project off the ground.
Interesting. Was there enormous support for that joint mission? Compare it to Skylab, for example.
Support from the general public.
From the general public. Was the TV networks just chomping at the bits to cover it? What was all that like?
There seemed to be more support for ASTP than there was for Skylab, but more so because of the geopolitical situation. The Americans were just fascinated. The general public, I'm speaking of here, were fascinated that their space agency could work with the Russian space agency on a joint effort. And that was intriguing. I don't know really if that meant there was more support for it, but there was definitely more viewing quota in the transmissions from ASTP than they ever were for Skylab.
When Skylab was ending and coming down, what was the public's opinion on that? Were we apathetic? How did that get recorded?
That was mayhem. We were just watching before the phone call, just doing a quick refresher on Skylab, and I was watching some of the telecast from the news. from 1979. And I remember as a school kid, you know, we were in a panic, fearing for our lives, thinking that that thing was going to, of all the houses in the whole world, it's going to fall on ours. And that's the mentality of pretty much everybody in the Western world, were paranoid that it was going to hit them. And the news departments were whipping it up into a frenzy, and it was major. There was major coverage of this.
Were people upset that the program was ending? Or apathetic?
Apathetic. When I look at it now, I think it is such a shame that they never got round to the boost mission, had the shuttle flown in the late 70s rather than in 1981. They had a plan to boost Skylab into its proper orbit, keep it up there for I suppose, a decade thereabouts, and send the shuttle to it. And that never... They nixed that project before it got off the ground, so it never happened. So they just let the thing fall back to Earth. And today, when I look at it, I just think, what a wasted opportunity. It would have been such a fascinating station to keep up there and do experiments from.
Absolutely, but I've heard that they couldn't have kept it up there no matter what, so I don't know what the real truth is. I guess maybe it's in the eyes of the beholder.
I just
don't know. Were you able to talk to the astronauts involved leading up to it, or the work crews, or, you know, the support teams? How many opportunities did you get to talk directly with the people who did these two missions?
I met with Tom Stafford, and he was fascinated that somebody took the time to talk about television because of his efforts in 1969 to get color television on Apollo 10. And he was elated that somebody was looking into the ASTP project. I spoke mostly with the television engineer, Stan Labar, prior to his passing. I was emailing him 5 days before his passing, which was such a shame because I had so many more questions to ask him, and I was just getting into gear doing the research for the second book, and found out from his son that he didn't make it through the operation for a lung tumor. So that was a great loss. I was lucky enough to have a lot of documentation from the day, written by specific individuals relating to the work and the preparation for it. So it felt like I was there, even though I didn't necessarily always get the chance to speak to astronauts. For example, Alan Bean I've spoken to, but it's always a very brief talk with them. You don't have that much time. You've got to think your questions very, very carefully because you know they've got maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes at the most.
Right.
And it's just like, tell me this, and you just hope to God they answer the responses you want. The one astronaut who helped me immensely was Bruce McCandless. I met him at a autograph show in London, and asked him if he'd be interested in writing the foreword for the second book, and he was like, "Yeah, of course, I'd love to." I gave him a copy of the first book. I said, "Read through it. If you like what you read, and you're happy to write the foreword for the second book, I'd be honoured to have you do it." And he said, "Yeah, sure, not a problem. Here's my email." And then 2 weeks later, I shot him off an email and said, "Did you have a chance to read it?" And his response was, "Boy, did I ever!" Exclamation mark! I'll be happy to write the introduction. And then on top of that, he did a preliminary proofread of the book and corrected certain things pertaining to his MMU development, the manned maneuvering unit.
Right.
It just offered little bits and pieces. He was telling me about the television training that they had for Skylab, that they had for the shuttle missions, and was always there to help answer a question or two that I had. By that time, the manuscript was pretty much finished. It was just like little fine details that he helped immensely with, and I'm eternally grateful to him.
Josh is in Tucson, Arizona, and he says, how important overall was being able to broadcast television to NASA and the astronauts and the personnel on Skylab, and the Apollo mission, were they really keyed up that television was mandatory, or did they just feel compelled to do it because of network pressure, maybe some pressure from the American people, but they just as soon wished they hadn't done it?
Hi, Josh. Well, with this now will sort of tail backwards into live TV from the moon. Prior to Apollo 7, there was a lot of division within NASA. Certain people wanted television. Certain people didn't want it and were adamant that they didn't want it. That slowly changed once Apollo 8 transmitted back from the moon. It really hit home when Apollo 12 lost the camera on the surface of the moon. The switchboard lit up like a Christmas tree, according to Stan Labar, who was on site. And by the time Skylab was in preparation, there was no question that there would not be television. It was always in the planning, and it was enthusiastically endorsed by everybody. I think the one stipulation was that it didn't interfere with essential activities on the space station or on any of the missions. For example, Apollo Soyuz or the space shuttle.
But quite the opposite from Russia, from the Soviet Union, right?
Yes and no. That was very difficult. Most of the documentation I had from the Russian side was material that was stored by NASA. The one thing I did learn from it was the launch of Soyuz and the landing of Soyuz. That was pretty much the first time that the Russian public had ever seen their space missions in real time. So when they saw the Soyuz capsule landing at the end of the ASTP project, that was the first time they had ever seen that live on television.
Interesting. Well, yeah, I remember when we got to see our rocket failures and everything. They never showed any of this stuff on television. You know, it was all put down in the deep, dark basement, for sure. Do you think our space program would have evolved differently had Skylab stayed up there?
I would like to think so. The little secret now, when I first started researching the first book, I was adamant Apollo was the best thing NASA had ever done, and you could never convince me otherwise. And I remember vividly one of the first books I got, Skylab by David Shaler. I looked at it and went, well, look, I'll get it because it's post-Apollo, but I'm really not interested, right?
Now,
my opinion since I've researched that has gone 180 degrees, and I actually find Skylab the pinnacle of what NASA had achieved. They had a limited budget. They turned and looked inwards onto the Earth, and they did so many experiments there. And the stuff that you watch today, and you think, why don't they show this to kids at school? If I had had this when I was a kid, and this is already after Skylab had happened, I would understand physics way more than I ever did through a textbook. You've got an astronaut there. One of my favorite video footage is of Bill Pogue showing orbital mechanics, and he has three spheres in front of him, and they're floating relative to him, stable, until they maneuver the space station into an adjusted orbit. And you see these three spheres move upwards out of the screen, and for me it's just like, oh, what? You'd never see that on Earth. Never, ever would you see that on Earth. And for me it's just fascinating stuff to watch.
Bill told some great stories on the space show about Skylab and what they were doing. So then, well, here, I'll give you this question. Gene is in San Diego, California, and he says, can you give some kind of a comparison that might be relevant between the ISS and Skylab?
Well, one thing I can tell you about the ISS compared to Skylab is all the data they use to plan missions to develop medical observations is all based on Skylab. Everything that they learned on Skylab, they apply today, and that is nearly 40 years later. That is how important and how detailed the work and the research they did on Skylab was.
So Skylab is holding its own even in the modern world then?
Absolutely. When I found that out, I was like, wow, that is amazing.
Did they set out to do that level of research, or was research just that much better back then with NASA people than what we may see today?
I think it was just a little bit more compounded. There's the story about the mutiny that the Skylab 4 crew did, that they were just overworked. And they said, look, no, we are having a day off today. Regardless of what the mission plan says, we can't handle this work. There was a lot of research done and a lot of records kept. And that continues to aid researchers and planners to this day.
Interesting. I'd be fun to see if the astronauts on the ISS would take a strike and demand a day off. Except they do get days off, but yeah, I think that's probably a little bit different. Here's another question for you. Alex is in Los Angeles, and he says, what could have been done differently in these programs to retain the population's interest to sustain it so that it would have carried on into future space programs that were meaningful?
Well, I don't think there's much they could have done because they really pulled out all the stops for... by the time Apollo-Soyuz flew, they had four cameras and they could switch between those four cameras. They could... It was like a mini studio up in space, and they had the VTR, so they could record stuff and send it down later. And I've watched the mission video numerous times, and I think, wow, if they could have done that on the lunar surface, that would have kept the public imagination going for lunar missions, more than likely. The debate's still open. But by the time they got to ASTP, they had television down to a fine art, and then they stopped with the space missions until 1981. It's like, every time they had the momentum, it's like, no, well, okay, we're stopping.
Well, that seems to be what government does best at times, isn't it?
Yes. Yes.
I guess, you know, it's hard to imagine what would have happened if Skylab had been able to stay up there. Would we have the space station? Would we have that international partnership agreement? How things might have been different? Would we have gone to Mars? Do you at all cover any topics like that? Do you look forward in your book?
Other than with complete despair that that thing was prematurely ended, no, unfortunately I don't. I touch on a little bit at the very end about how technology from the private sector has overtaken the development from NASA. And that was a comment made to me by Max Engert when I spoke to him via telephone when I was doing the first book, and he said, look, the next big revolution's not coming from NASA, it's going to come from the private sector. And when I started looking at the space shuttle, I thought, oh my God, it had already happened. You know, when they flew the Palm Quarter up in the mid-80s, that was the end of the sequential color system. They had finally been overtaken by the very industry that they had revolutionized decades earlier. You know, and up until the last flight, okay, they still had, for the payload bay, they had the old cameras, but for all the internal astronaut activity cameras, they were all off-the-shelf palm quarters.
How do you organize your book, Live TV, from orbit? What's the sequence you have the reader go through?
Right, I do the Skylab first, and I cover planning prior to the first mission. Then I detail, as much as the available footage allowed me to, what happened on the mission. Then I go through Skylab, so in essence, Skylab 2, 3, and 4. Then I talk about Apollo-Soyuz test project, and I go through all the pre-planning right through to the flight. I describe as well the flight. And then I go through to space shuttle development, describing as well the ALT tests and the lead-up up until the very first flight. Then the very last chapter of the book describes, as concise as possible, what happened following STS-1 as far as television development in the space shuttle project.
James is in Phoenix, Arizona. He said, David, I'm at work, so I'm using email. Can you ask your guest if in any of his research, if he came across an effort by NASA to be seriously concerned about lowering the cost of accessing space, was that ever part of what he saw that NASA had in mind in doing any of these projects?
There was very brief discussion about that prior to the shuttle being launched. There was a very brief exchange of memos. I can't recall who. It was within NASA to make space accessible to the everyday person. They wanted it to be a window on the activities of astronauts. And that was the very first time that I read anything other than engineering evaluation to use television as a window for the public.
Well, their efforts didn't work if they really tried it, did they?
It's unfortunate. I have highlights of STS-1 through to the 10th mission. And once you start watching them and you appreciate what they had worked on, then it becomes extremely fascinating. But if you don't have that ground knowledge, then you look at it and go, what's this? This is boring.
You need to have the background of how this got developed and implemented, and you don't get that unless someone does what you did. But that puts the public at a disadvantage, because we all know the public isn't going to do what you did.
Yeah, true. Hopefully my little book here helps alleviate that problem a little bit.
possibly. Who are heroes of the era?
Heroes of the era.
Uh-huh.
All the Skylab guys and all the ones working in the background.
So how many people worked in the background for Skylab?
Pretty much the same amount that were working on Apollo, because Skylab in itself was an extension of Apollo, which originated as Apollo Applications Program, and it became an entity on its own once they cancelled Apollo's 18, 19, and 20. So the people that were working on Apollo in most cases kept on working on the Skylab project. Some of the news reports at the end of Skylab, that's when they start addressing the fact that people are now facing losing their jobs, because the only mission coming up is ASTP, and that's it until the space shuttle flies. And that's where there was genuine concern about people losing their jobs. But up until that time, it was pretty much situation normal for everybody.
What about, was there any kind of an upstairs-downstairs relationship with the astronauts and the people in the public versus those in the background making the missions possible?
Not that I could see. I mean, what I've found watching and speaking to the Skylab and ASTP astronauts, they tend to be always working or lurking in the shadows of Apollo. And when somebody starts talking to them, they have a lot of time to explain what they did on those missions. I just said a couple of minutes earlier that they don't have that much time when they're talking to me, but that's I'm meaning when they're talking in news reports or in conferences. When they had the 40th anniversary of Skylab last year, it was amazing to listen to Jerry Carr and Owen Garriott just talk about what they were doing on the missions, because unlike Apollo, Skylab is not that well known in the public consciousness.
Probably not. Here's a fun question for you. And this is from Harry, and Harry's in Boston. And he says, I'm also at work, so I'm using email, David. I was a little kid during the Apollo-Soyuz flight, and I remember my mom and dad got Apollo-Soyuz memos and gadgets and toys to commemorate the mission. I know I have buttons, I have Lucky Strike cigarette packs, and other things put away. Do you think these mementos of that flight have any value?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, not as much as lunar Apollo material, but the cigarettes I see on eBay all the time, and they're becoming harder to find as the years go by.
What do they sell for on eBay, do you remember?
God, that was the last time I looked, I think $10 a packet.
Okay.
I can't remember. I haven't looked at them for quite a while. I picked up a set of Russian printed documentation for the Soyuz capsule for the Americans, printed in English. They're worth, per pamphlet, which is around about 12 pages, they're worth around about $250-$300. The thing with those, that type of memorabilia, it's because it's from an unknown or relatively unknown mission, it tends to be more obscure, and therefore the people that are on the lookout for that sort of stuff are more interested in what they're looking for. Like, for example, everybody and their dog would say, yeah, I'd love an autograph photo by Neil Armstrong, but you tell them, oh, what about one from Tom Stafford? They go, who's that? Whereas somebody who's interested in the projects will go, wow, an autographed photo by Tom Stafford, commander of Apollo-Soyuz test project, that is a big deal. So it's in the eye of the beholder, I would say, but those type of things tend to command a pretty decent price on for eBay, I know for a fact, and on auction houses, they tend to have them going for good prices as well. If you head over to www.collectspace.com, there you'll get a very good idea of what's currently hot in the collecting world of space.
Interesting. We're at our halfway point, so let's take our pause here because we can actually cut right at the right point. Time does go by fast. Listeners, we're going to be gone for about 3 minutes, and we will be back, and we will hopefully have some of you call in who are not at work and can use your phone. That toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. And, of course, your emails are still welcome, drspace@thespaceshow.com. We're back in 3 minutes, everybody. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
Welcome back, everybody. This is part two of The Space Show. I'm your host, David Livingston. Our guest today, Dwight Stephen Bonecki, and we're talking about his new book, Live TV from Orbit, which is about Apollo, not about Apollo, Skylab and the Apollo-Soyuz test project. Dwight, who ultimately built the cameras for Skylab and Apollo, and was that a cutthroat competitive bid process, or how did that happen?
The cameras for Skylab were built by Westinghouse, were basically the follow-on models that they used on Apollo. Very similar design, updated, of course, then with 1973 technology, which was nothing that major, but the requirements of the internal wiring of Skylab necessitated more advanced electronics like switching and so forth. Stan Labar was relating to me the proposal procedure, and they weren't really enthused about having to deal with the same sort of politics they had in the lead-up to the Apollo moon landing. And he advised Larkin Niemeyer, who was the representative for Westinghouse, to go into NASA and say, we are not putting up with bureaucracy, we do it our way or we don't do it at all. Apparently at this meeting, NASA started to try shoveling bureaucracy onto him at the very first meeting. He just got up, walked to the elevators, and just left without even saying goodbye. They followed after him, said, sorry, come back in. And they sat him down, and then negotiated the deal, and then it was left up to Westinghouse to get the camera system off the ground for Skylab. For Apollo-Soyuz test project, it was also Westinghouse. The biggest logistical nightmare there was to try and find which part of the world would be best to telecast the handshake, because that was sent down live, and that I definitely know the news carriers telecast in the United States, pretty much all around the world. They ended up had a system in place in West Germany to receive that television signal, which is roughly, I think it was over East Germany, where the handshake actually took place. For the space shuttle, it was RCA that went in with a fixed price contract. Westinghouse, although they would have loved to have designed and built the cameras for the shuttle, Stan was relating to me that they were just not interested in the costs. They were looking at saving money, and they just knew that given the track record of the shuttle at the time they were thinking about proposing, it was not worth their time and effort to pitch for it. Westinghouse bowed out of it. RCA got the contract. They were the only ones in the position to do it, and it apparently cost them a pretty fortune to get that camera system ready for STS-1.
When did they? How long did they continue using videotape before they went digital?
Videotape was used. I know they did in 1987, if memory serves correct. I've just got the book in front of me. They did a complete modification of the shuttle system. I'll just get you the date there. Yes, upgrades were implemented in 1987. I would imagine digital videotape came about when the digibeaters first hit the market, so in the early to mid-90s, I would imagine.
And did they just use regular videotape like we would buy at the drugstore, or was their videotape customed to?
The videotape systems they used on Skylab ASTP were specially designed 2-inch formats that could record up to half an hour of video. And these recorders were then remotely controlled from Earth. They could be controlled by the astronauts, but Houston could also control them when they wanted to do the material dumps over the receiving station like we had discussed in the first half of the show. The videotape system on the space shuttle, this is a difficult one because it changed sort of over the course of the time, so I don't want to say, yes, it was standard 2-inch tape, when in fact it wasn't, because they did change and they modified them throughout the course of the shuttle's career. I definitely know that the cameras in the payload bay were black and white. The cameras inside the cabin were color, and they could be switched between color and black and white. And they were also the sequential color up until 1987, where they then became standard prism cameras, just like the basic studio cameras or home cameras that people use. And then, of course, in the late 80s, early 90s, that's when the palm quarters came on board.
Now, not all Skylab launches and missions were without incident or problems. Do you want to talk about a few of those? I think you have them detailed in one of the chapters in the book.
The biggest problem with Skylab was when the heat shield was ripped off and one of the solar panels didn't deploy properly, and that nearly put the death knell on the entire project. And it was thanks to the Conrad White and Kerwin crew that they managed to deploy the solar panel with an EVA that was televised, whether it went out on the networks. That's actually, if one of the listeners could possibly help, if they can recall whether that was broadcast live on the networks, that would be extremely helpful, because it's a debate I've got going at the moment and I couldn't answer the person that asked me. So any help would be most appreciated. The other major problem that happened on Skylab 3, the Bean crew, one of the quad thrusters was not working properly on the command module. They had the rescue team standing by, And through a numerous set of tests and simulations on the ground, they opted not to go with the rescue. Skylab 4, the biggest problem that happened on Skylab 4 was the mutiny. Started in part as well when Bill Pogue had space sickness and the crew decided not to telecast, not to broadcast the information down to the ground. They kept it quiet. They discussed the problem in the command module and didn't realize that the onboard tape recorders were recording and did their usually scheduled dump later in the day. And of course, the ground heard about it without the crew knowing, and they got a reprimand the next day from Alan Shepard. As far as problems on ASTP, the biggest one was when they returned to Earth and the noxious gases from outside, they vented the capsule too early, and the crew passed out or nearly passed out as they were resting on the ocean's surface. And that caused a bit of post-mission nausea, but you wouldn't know it when you see the video of them exiting the spacecraft on the aircraft carrier. And from the space shuttle, the biggest dilemma facing the crew was when they turned the television cameras on and were doing a sweep of the spacecraft, they noticed a couple of the heat tiles had come off on launch. And then through discussion with the ground, they determined that it was safe to return to Earth.
Interesting. They made the wrong decision on that with Columbia, of course.
Yeah.
You said they had a rescue vehicle ready on, one of the missions. How would they have rescued people from Skylab?
They had a modified command module which could seat three crew, but it would have launched with only two astronauts from Florida, would have docked with the space station and would have then transported all three of them back down to Earth. It was a modified cabin. The seating arrangement was modified to allow all the crew to go into the... It was cramped, of course, but they would be able to return that way.
So that was their rescue plan. We'll send up a vehicle, dock with it, and get you off of Skylab.
Yes. The Skylab space station had multiple docking ports. All they would have had to do was dock the new command module onto the space station. They would have ditched everything else and gotten into that one and come back down to Earth.
Benny is in Los Angeles listening, and Benny says, I've heard that solar activity caused the Skylab to more rapidly deteriorate in its orbit. Can you verify that?
Yes, that was the case. That they had not anticipated the solar activity to cause the space station to... alter its orbit, and in the long term, that then caused it to prematurely decay its orbit and fall back to Earth. And part of the rescue plan was to send up a robotic rocket booster, that would attach to the station and would move the thing back into a stable orbit, provided the space shuttle had launched in time, and of course it didn't, so that that project was cancelled before it even got beyond planning stages.
Do you think we would have done the ISS had we not done Skylab?
Oh, difficult to say. I think so. I think despite recent events with the Crimea, the world can only afford to do space exploration in a joint capacity.
So we have to have international participation is what you're saying?
I think so. Of course, NASA is funding the greater part of the ISS, but still there are a lot of other countries adding to the project, and I think that's just the way it's going to be. I mean, the European Space Agency has a cooperation agreement. They supplied Space Lab for the space shuttle. That's how I see the future of space travel.
Lee is in Houston, Texas, and he says, I'm also at work. Can you tell us about the actual complexities of the design and interior of Skylab as compared to the space station? Is the space station significantly more advanced than what Skylab was?
The ISS is definitely more advanced, but not as spacious, and that is the biggest comparison I can make. When the Skylab astronauts look at video footage of the ISS, they go, "Oh, we had it very, very luxurious on Skylab." there's footage of the astronauts doing acrobatics, doing somersaults, running in a similar fashion to the way on 2001 the astronaut is running. Doing jogging around the ring of the spacecraft. That's what they were doing on Skylab, and they telecast that. It was, I think the spacious factor is the biggest difference between Skylab and the ISS.
What about with Mir? Did you look into or do any comparisons with Mir in the ISS or Skylab?
No, unfortunately not with Mir. I didn't do anything comparative-wise.
So, so we just have to leave that then, I guess, right?
Yeah, sorry about that.
the launch vehicles for Skylab and Apollo test flight, today there's all of these people that are saying NASA's too risk-averse, you know, and so we're building the commercial rockets like SpaceX, for example. Was there any indication of NASA heading toward being fairly risk-averse? And back in the day, did anybody contemplate commercial, private launch vehicles for profit? I know that the launch vehicles are made by private companies under contract to NASA, but that's something different from what I'm asking. Was any of this commercial SpaceX type of Rock, was any of this at all thought about or talked about or planned for or recommended back then?
Not in any of the documentation I could find. The one shift in sort of attitude that I did notice once I started getting into space shuttle development, that's where the risk aversion really kicked in.
With the shuttle?
Yes. Yeah, you can read it. When you read the internal memos and documentation, it is a very corporate type of style, whereas the Skylab ASTP and Apollo stuff is very test pilot-y. I don't know if that's a good distinction to make, but you can read the difference.
And shuttle was not test pilot-oriented?
It was, but it's just the general structure within NASA had become much more hierarchical, much more like a modern-day corporation, I would say, whereas the early style NASA was risk-taking and we will do this because we need to be the first. With the space shuttle, it was, how do we do this with minimal risk to anybody's life?
Interesting. That you can actually pick that up. Here's another email. A lot of people in L.A. are listening to the show today. This is Anthony, and he's over at the Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles. Have you ever been to the Griffith Observatory?
No, I haven't. My wife has, not me, unfortunately.
Well, when you find yourself back in Los Angeles someday, you need to put it on your plans as a must-visit. It's really cool. He says, I want to check a recollection that I have from Apollo-Soyuz mission. I remember President Ford talking live to the joint crews of the mission. He addressed a comment to Deke Slayton and went on and on describing meals on the ground while Slayton smiled attentively. After what seemed like an eternity, Ford finally asked a question about the quality of food to Deke, who only continued to smile attentively but with no reaction. One of the other astronauts nudged Slayton, who then grabbed his microphone and headset and said, I'm sorry, I didn't get that, Mr. President. I remember that Ford sounded embarrassed because there was no time to repeat the question, thank goodness, and wished everyone well before contact with the ground station was lost. is my memory from 40 years ago correct? Was this a snub on Deke's part?
Nothing that I could pick up. He definitely spoke with them live on television. That's the first I've ever heard of that, so I couldn't really comment on that. I do know about Alexei Leonov responding, oh, it's not a matter of the type of meal or the quality of the meal you eat, it's with whom you eat it.
So were they okay with whom they were eating it?
Yeah, very much so. And that's another interesting fact. When I was at a convention where both Alexei Leonov and Tom Stafford were present, those two were like two schoolboy friends that have never lost touch with each other. They were saying how great their friendship is, and it has been maintained since the early 70s. So those friendships have survived to this day.
Interesting. Thank you, Anthony, for your question. Listeners, again, I'll give out the phone number, 1-866-687-7223. If you were, you know, the historian of final, I don't know what the word would be, of final value or final tabulator for our space program, a mission could get a highest rating of 10 and a lowest rating of 0, where would you put Skylab missions on that scale, and where would you put the Apollo-Soyuz test project?
Apollo-Soyuz test project. That is a difficult one because I very much am impressed with that mission, despite the fact that for the most part it was a PR exercise. I just think that the foresight that they had there to be able to work with a Cold War adversary and pull off a mission as successful as ASTP was is admirable. And I would put ASTP probably around 8.5. Skylab, I would put between 9.5 and 10.
That high?
Yeah.
Where biased. You're biased. Obviously, where would you put the Apollo missions that went to the moon?
Oh, they're a very close second. I will say that in doing the research for the second book, prior to it, I was like, it's Apollo or nothing. Since then, I have changed my opinion dramatically on Skylab, and I would say, I don't know about rating it, but it's definitely my personal favorite of all the missions, of all the projects.
But, you know, during the first 4 or 5 years that I was doing the space show, I would usually ask callers and guests, how did you get your interest in space or your career in space, or why did you do a PhD on some space topic or something like that? And almost everyone cited the Apollo program, including Mercury and Gemini, you know, the efforts to go to the moon and to go to the moon. I don't recall anybody mentioning Skylab, the International Space Station, the Apollo-Soyuz test project, or space shuttle. They might have mentioned satellite missions, you know, or rovers going someplace, but it was primarily, the inspiration came from our moon program. So again, nobody, it's like Skylab and the Apollo-Soyuz test project were never, ever mentioned on the space show with people, unless my guest was specifically talking about those projects.
Yeah, in my case as a kid, I came directly out of the shadows of Apollo. I do have childhood memories of watching the astronauts performing certain experiments on Skylab. I do remember the handshake in space from ASTP, and I remember the ALT flights of Enterprise. For me, it was always like, oh, wow, when the space shuttle finally flies, it's going to be fantastic. We are truly going to be in the space era that I imagine the future to be. So for me, I would say, growing up with the anticipation of the shuttle, that's what did it for me. Having said that, my father was very, very much influenced by the Apollo moon program.
Kirsten is in Fargo, North Dakota, and she says, what was life like on the Russian side of the Apollo-Soyuz mission? Did the population know a lot about it? Did they care about it? Did they see the handshake live? What can you tell us about the Russian side of this?
The Russians definitely were watching live. There are photographs you can find around the internet of the Russian population in looking in store windows. In those days, not everybody had a television set.
Right.
So, but those that didn't would go, like there's footage of the Apollo 11 moon landing in Australia. You know, in those days, not everyone had a TV set, so they were standing in front of a store window. In Russia, they didn't necessarily have stores. We could get the TV set, but they would have a government agency that had a TV set in the window, and they could watch it there. So they definitely were watching it. It was a big deal for the Russians.
And the aftermath of it, was it a big deal in the aftermath, too, that it had a long-lasting appeal in the country?
The Russians have always tended to be very, very proud of the feats they've done in space exploration. And we watched a movie that has been released in Russia now called Gagarin. And it's about Yuri Gagarin's first space flight. And the way it is filmed, you do get a sense of pride. And the Russians have never let go of that pride, of the fact that they were the first in space. And they've maintained a very steady program since then. And I think with ASTP, the general public's participation in that program was the beginning of opening the cracks to let them be more involved in it. It was a very slow process, but it had long-lasting effects, that's for sure.
So it opened the cracks for the Russian people to be more aware and involved in their own space program.
That's right. And the other thing it did, it was very long-term, opening the cracks between joint participation between nations.
Interesting that they had that big of an impact with it. Of course, we're doing joint missions with the Russians and everything else. I'm sure you're aware of the NASA memo that went out, I guess it was on Wednesday, as a result of the Crimea thing and the Ukraine, we're supposed to be having no more contact with the Russians on their space program other than directly related to the space station. What do you think of that?
Well, I think it was pretty much inevitable with what's going on at the moment. It's almost comical in a way how it mimics the film 2010 to a T. I'm pretty sure the astronauts up in the space station are just going, what in the hell is this garbage all about? We'll just wait and see what happens. I think it's, like I said, inevitable. I'll probably wind up getting way too political if I started going down that path. So I'll leave it by saying, hopefully it changes pretty quickly. And I don't mean just that decision, but the whole mess that's caused that thing in the first place.
What is the CD have on it that's in the back of the book?
Oh, this has lots of goodies for people who have everything on Apollo, but don't know that much about Skylab. And from what I can gather, even the people who are very well versed in Skylab and ASTP don't tend to have the footage that I've obsessively collected in the last 10 years. There are highlights of the docking from Apollo-Soyuz test project, the handshake. You've got the launch of Apollo, the launch of Soyuz. Unfortunately, the quality is not that crash hot because of the source material I had it from. And because of the fact that in those days, converting from the CCAM system, which is the television system they use used in the Soviet Union, they had to optically convert it. So you just got a degraded picture quality. You can still see what's going on, but I'm not going to claim it's pristine HD quality. Now, then you have Skylab material. You have the EVA to repair the solar panel. Have Pete Conrad sitting at the ATM console, the in-orbit press conference. From Skylab 3, you have airlock, data recorder repair, and blood sampling. And from Skylab 4, you have Christmas messages and the orbital mechanics demonstration, the one that I was raving about as my favorite footage. You also have a complete station tour with Jack Lausner. Then you have a whole bunch of documentation. You have a reprint of the Russian Soyuz radio and TV communications, the document that I said is a piece of memorabilia that I have. And lots of other little hidden goodies and access to something new from the good people at Apogee, and that is the Space Library. And if you want pretty much all the video you can find on Skylab and ASTP, you follow the link on the DVD. Don't forget to support the author so we can have real meat for evening tea. And you can click on different videos of those missions that I've put up there, especially for readers of the book.
Where is the Space Library?
There is a link on the DVD, and it goes straight to that. So you need to put the disc in the computer, and that will lead you straight to it as part and package of the book. To give you a website address, I'm afraid I can't do that. I don't know it off the top of my head.
You have a chapter called Full Circle that I wanted to ask you about. What's the Full Circle? This is around the end of the program.
Yeah, this is just where all the things that they envisioned, you know, small portable cameras that could be held in the palm of your hand, it finally happened that way. That the, like I was saying before, the revolution that NASA had started in miniaturizing, or NASA or Westinghouse and RCA had in miniaturizing all the TV gear, had come full circle. The private sector had latched on to the ideas and the progress that they had made, and finally the private sector had outpaced the NASA developments.
Pretty interesting that happened. In also the palm that went up there, that of course is all gone technology down too.
So
they sent a palm device up there. I guess it was a smartphone back then. I don't know. But,
no, just the Sony camcorder.
Just a Sony camcorder. And that's, look at what's in our video cameras now with the technology from the private sector. And people who are launching CubeSats and balloon launches use smartphone cameras in their satellites.
So
looking forward, what do you think of commercial launches? Like what SpaceX is wanting to do and wanting to build big rockets and these plans to both start living on Mars with Mars One, as well as Inspiration Mars, which is to fly around Mars.
I look forward to it. I really look forward to it. At the moment, there seems to be a bit of a lull in new things space. So I'll be happy to see what the future brings. Having said that, what Chris Hadfield had done up in the ISS was absolutely fantastic for the whole space program. He really brought it to the public consciousness again, and that is by no means a small feat.
Absolutely. Since Mars One is headquartered in Holland, do you get a lot of news about that? Is that a big deal in Europe and Germany, from what you can tell?
Not really. They tend to make a bit of a song and dance about the fact that it's a one-way trip. But then, as somebody pointed out, you know, when people went over to the United States from Europe, that was a one-way trip as well.
Except they could come back if they wanted to, I guess, right?
Yeah. True. I don't know. As intriguing as it sounds, I don't think I'd want to give up living on this planet. This is too beautiful a planet to want to leave.
So you don't think it's a big issue? You don't pick it up on the newspaper every day or hear about it all the time or see hundreds or thousands of people rushing to be on the Mars mission?
No, not here. Nothing out of the ordinary. Most of the news I get from it, I actually get from U.S.-based space news services. So there's not, that's a big negative in the way of space reporting here in Europe.
Crystal is in Miami. And Crystal says, David, I'm also at work. Here's my question. If you look at a modern day launch, the photography on the different parts of the rocket all the way to orbit is unbelievable, streaming live. And in fact, when they launched the Mars Science Lab, you could watch the separation and see it head out toward Mars, all on live TV. Do these cameras, is all of this technology a direct descendant from what you're talking about in the early days of our space program, or did it come about completely different from sources completely different?
No, that is direct descendant. Of course, the cameras these days are built by private industry.
Right.
But the proposal to have cameras within the, in those days, manned space flight, that goes back to the early 60s, prior to even the Gemini flights, if I remember correctly. That was a long, long, long time ago that they first proposed having real-time video during a launch. And in fact, the Apollo cameras, all of them, the black and white RCA cameras used on Apollo 7 and 8, the Lunar Module camera, and the Westinghouse command module cameras, they were all designed to withstand the vibration and the shock of a launch. They had intended at some point to be able to telecast from the cabins as the thing launched.
I just know when you watch the launch cameras on the sides of the rockets and you can watch it all the way to orbit, it's unbelievable that we get those pictures.
That's awesome stuff. And that's actually, I sort of allure to it a little bit of the very closing statements of the book, that, you know, even today with all the quote, boring space launches, you know, you still sit there and go, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, I make reference to the Simpsons episode where they make mockery of routine space flights from NASA becoming so boring that the Simpson family want to change the channel. And unfortunately, that has reflected on the American psyche as with regards to space flight.
Well, if you ever watch a spacewalker, a mission on NASA TV, it can be pretty boring too.
Yeah, I've only ever streamed it. I don't actually get the channel here. Mind you, having said that, I'll say this much. When the Chinese rover on the lunar surface first started operations, they covered that very, very heavily here in Europe. So the avenue is there. If NASA was to do the same thing, I am sure they would get the same amount of coverage.
Of course, nobody takes China for granted, and yet I'm sure NASA's, everybody just kind of takes it for granted and moves on. You know, they make the complex look so simple that, you know, I think it cost them some of their PR and some of their audience and some of their support.
Yeah.
What's next for you? What's your next book?
Ooh, I don't know. I do have a couple of ideas more relating to my grandfather. He was a pilot in World War One, and I inherited a whole bunch of photo albums from him. The problem being, he was on the bad guy's side, so I've got to sort of delicately maneuver through that. What I would like to do is go to the countries that he took photos in during his time in the war, and do a 100-year later expose of how it looks now, what are the thoughts of the people that lived there as to how the whole war affected their ancestors. And I don't know, take it from there. I was lucky enough to get his complete war record, so I know exactly where he was stationed to the day. So that's something I was considering doing. I don't know how that's going to come about, what I need to do in order to get that happening, but that's something I'm sort of toying with.
This is possibly your last question of the day. This is Becky is in St. Louis, Missouri, and she says, my husband has the book that you're talking about and has enjoyed reading it, and I've been looking through it and thumbing through it, listening to the show today. How did you come across and get access to all of the drawings, the diagrams, and the pictures that are in this book?
With a simple phrase, with great difficulty. I was at the right place at the right time. A lot of the documentation that you see in the book, where a lot of the graphics come from, they came from the JSC History Archive. Now, a lot of that documentation that I actually, so you can submit a list, or you could in when I was doing it, of the material you required. They would scan it or photocopy it to you, charge you, and then send it out for, you know, they charge you for the photocopying costs. I received an email in the middle of all this saying to me, you better hurry up because they're moving a lot of this stuff over to the National Archives, and once it goes there, it's going to be very, very difficult to get your hands on. So you can imagine I just went into panic mode, and I thought, okay, thank God for the credit card, and I just got everything and anything related to Skylab, ASTP, Space Shuttle, TV. So the good side effect of that now is that that material has been scanned, and the scans are still available at the JSC History Portal. A lot of the other stuff, I happen to be lucky. I have had access to video material from JSC that the general public can't get. Just, I think, on the fact of the first book that I've actually got a bit of a name for myself, so I was able to get access to get this material. Luck and perseverance is all I can say.
Luck and perseverance.
Yep.
Did you know? So you had to just look through things in order to choose what you wanted, because you didn't know what would be available to say, I want a picture of this or that.
That's right. When you go to the history site or the archives, they will usually have an abstract, so you can read roughly what it's all about. I just did a search, Skylab Television, Skylab TV, AAP TV, and everything that came through with television, I thought, I don't care. I will get it and worry about whether it's related to what I need later on, but at least I've got it. And that's how and then, of course, you read through the reports and you see, oh, here's a very interesting diagram of where they want to put the cameras on the space shuttle. And so I would use that diagram from that particular report.
How would you summarize your work in the book, given that we're moving into the close of the program? Or what would our takeaways be from that you would want us to hold on to about these programs?
I find myself fortunate and honored to have been able to speak with the people who, some of which are no longer with us, who helped bring all this stuff about. And I'm glad that, you know, if it hadn't have been me, I'm sure it would have been somebody else that had taken the time and effort to write about it and preserve these memories, because of all the things that have been said to me by the astronauts, Tom Stafford said to me, thank you for preserving this for future generations. Bruce McCandless, 2 weeks ago, looked at the book and he said, you've done a wonderful job preserving this. And everybody's thoughts seem to be, thank you for preserving these memories for future generations to see.
And you did do that. Your book is excellent. Any way people can get an autographed copy from you, or are you doing that?
If I happen to be in town, I'm more than happy to.
Do you have a website for the book, or like a promotion schedule or anything like that you're going to do?
No, not at the moment. The problem being, because I'm in Germany, if you happen to have been in London, you could have come up to me, not a problem. I keep an eye on which astronauts are coming out to Europe, and if I happen to be there and you've got a copy of the book, I'm more than happy to sign it. I don't have very many copies left. The ones I do have need to go to people I've promised them to for years and years and years at the beginning of all the research. So time will tell, but I'm very approachable. Anybody who wants an autograph and dedicated version of the book are more than welcome to ask me. If I'm nearby, I'll happily do it for you for a big fee of $0.
Okay, unlike some of the astronauts who charge a ton for their signatures, right?
Buzz was in London. Oh, my God. He charged, I think it was £350 for his signature.
And Neil is gone, so, you know, if the market's there, why not capitalize on it?
Oh, speaking of Neil, I have to tell you this much. For the first book, that was at a time where I was getting a lot of queries from journalists regarding the book, and it was the 16th of July, and I'm going through emails, and I see live TV from the moon, and I go, oh, yeah, okay, I'm a journalist, and I scroll through it just to get the gist of it, and I zip past the name, and I'm like, what the hell? And I went back slowly, and it said Neil Armstrong. He sent me an email thanking me for doing the book. And I tell you, you could have heard my scream from the other side of the Atlantic.
Did you ever get to talk with Neil or meet him?
No, never. Unfortunately, never got to meet him. I only emailed him the couple of times just after that email.
And I take it you've met and talked with Buzz before, right?
Yes, I have. Yes, yes.
All right. Well, Dwight, it's a great book. And again, listeners, it's live TV from orbit. I'm assuming it's available on Amazon and most places where it can be ordered. And thank you for all of this great historical work. And I guess you've gone a long way to preserving this stuff and to educate generations that weren't around when any of these missions took place.
Yeah, it's been an honor for me to tell these guys' stories and these women's stories as well. It's I never in a million years as a small kid listening to Bruce McCandless's voice talking to the guys on the lunar surface on the recordings my father made, I never thought he'd be writing an introduction to my book. For me, I'm just humbled.
Okay, listen, I want to thank you very much for returning to the Space Show, and best of luck with your book and work. And if you do another space-related book, make sure you let me know. I'd be interested in talking to you again about it down the road.
Absolutely. I'd love to come on.
Okay.
That's always a pleasure.
Listeners, that's it from Dwight and myself today. So we wish you a great weekend. Keep it safe and have a good time, but above all, keep it safe. And we'll be back Sunday with our regular Sunday Space Show program. Thank you all for listening and participating today. Goodbye from the Space Show.